this evening's topic, advocacy updates, including an open memo to our president and disclosure petition for. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to this July 20th, 2012 edition of The Global Focus. Trish Sheridan speaking. Tonight's guest will be Stephen Bassett. The Global Focus program is broadcast live on 107.9 FM New Orleans and the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Thanks to Joe Montaldo for making these programs possible. Guest details and program listing venues can be found at globalfocus.com. Stephen Bassett, this evening's guest, is an exopolitical asset, an exopolitical activist as well, and a leading advocate for ending the 65-year government-imposed truth embargo regarding extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. Steve is the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group, and his advocacy work has been extensively covered by national and international media. He has spoken to audiences all over the world about the implications of formal disclosure of the ET presence. And you know, Steve, pardon my misspeaking there, but indeed you're an asset to the field, and you're absolutely the global exopolitical activist. We thank you so much for your work for this wonderful cause. And now, Steve, really interesting developments in your field and advocacy initiatives. Please tell us about your open memo this date to our President Obama, as well as disclosure petition 4. And if you'd like to read those, we'd be honored. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you, Patrice, as always. You never know when something's going to break in this genre. It can come at any time. And the job of PRG, Paranormal Research Group, is to be ready to take advantage of what comes along at any time. And the development appeared approximately 30 days ago in the form of one Charles Chase Brandon. He has a book out, which he's promoting, and that's fine. And as a result, he threw a little media. He turned up on, I think one of the very first media he did was Coast to Coast, AM, but not with George Norrie, with the one of the substitute hosts. And it definitely rang some bells, and as a result, he came back very shortly after that and did another interview with George. That's how significant that was. Now, what's going on here? Who am I talking about? Chase Brandon is a retired career CIA officer. 25 years in the clandestine services, 40 years overall with the CIA. He worked on all covert operations across a broad range of issues. He was also in training covert operatives. And so this guy is an expert in the world of the clandestine, right? The classic CIA guy. I mean, he's the model, in a way, in a sense, for the CIA guy. And then, and this is also notable, the last few years of his career there, I guess, you know, he had enough time in the field, time to bring him home, give him a little bit more of a relaxing job. He was the director of the first office set up by the CIA as a liaison to Hollywood. And his job was to assist film operations who wanted to come in and do documentaries on the CIA and so forth, obviously, to make sure that, I guess, that they were properly serviced and that try to help make sure the documentaries were accurate. And in return, of course, he provided liaison to Hollywood Films. Now, he has an IMDb page, International Media Database, very, very valuable resource, IMDb, and it shows some of the films that he worked with, but it's almost certain that he worked with a number of other films where he is not given credit, right, again, as a CIA liaison. So, interesting, very gregarious man, very talkative, definitely a PR savvy. And so he's written a book called Cryptos Conundrum. it's a science fiction, it's a fiction book, rather. And it's about the U.S. government covering up, in his phrase, the presence of extraterrestrials at Roswell, New Mexico. Okay, fine. Interesting. That would be interesting, certainly, but not profound. That if the ex-CIA guy would write a book about Roswell, yeah, what the hell? He's a talented writer, I'm sure. Except for one thing. When he did the interview on the coast, he made several statements. One was, and he's very clear about this, and I'm actually referring to both interviews on Coast to Coast, that his entire life, his entire adult life, he was quite certain Roswell was a crashed extraterrestrial vehicle and that there were non-human bodies. Okay, fine. I mean, a lot of people have that belief. A lot of people believe that is the case. And that's noted. But the second thing he said was that as it happened, while he was in one of the vault rooms, the it's called the HIC, the Historical Intelligence Collective. It's kind of a library as well. He was in there scouting for documentary space, bringing a documentary team. He was going through some of the boxes of files that were stored there, and he noticed one that had Roswell written on it. And as he stated on the air, he looked in the box. Remember, this is in CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia. And there were materials on Roswell. And what he stated was that after he'd gone through the box, he closed it, he put it up on the shelf, and he said, my God, it did really happen. He went on to say that the materials in the box confirmed what he already believed. It was confirmation. And, of course, what he believed was Roswell was an ET crash and that there were ET bodies. Now, that's a different matter altogether. And so it took a few days. The first article that popped up, as far as I'm able to research, was in Chile, believe it or not. And then about 6 days later, the article started turning up in the mainstream press around the world. One of the first ones was, in fact, by the LA Times. And so, what we have here is a very long-standing career service senior officer of the CIA saying, not only did I not believe, I'm certain, really, he thinks, things like that, I'm certain that Roswell was an alien craft, but I saw some documents in the CIA that confirmed it. Whatever those documents are, whether they were classified, you know, a lot of people don't, not everyone understands the classification systems and how they work, but this was inside the CIA, so theoretically everything's kind of classified in there, but not everything in level of security. So whatever, he saw this material announced, big deal. So this starts to become a significant story. And PRG immediately started tracking it, and at the Paradigm Research Group website, paradigmresearchgroup.org, you find the media archive, and you will see the archive of these articles as they are appearing. There have been quite a few, and I'll get back to that in a second. So, well, the first thing that I wanted to do was, one of the key things I had to do, is to keep the story alive as long as possible, to get it in front of the media more and help it have a long news cycle. And the way he did it was to file disclosure petition 4 to the White House. Now, we talked about this before, Teresa, as you know, that PRG is working a disclosure petition process with the White House website's We the People Project. This was started in September of last year. Yeah. They invited people to send petitions, get signatures for them. They publish them on the website, and they got enough signatures, you would get a formal White House response. One of the first, I think the third petition submitted was the disclosure petition 1, calling for the president to disclose. acknowledge the extraterrestrial presence, release all UFO files. It very quickly garnished 5,000 signatures, and as a result, on November 4th, it actually got a formal response from the White House. A few days after the first disclosure petition crossed the threshold for getting a response, which was 5,000, it ended up at 12,000 ultimately. The We the People project at thewhitehouse.gov increased the threshold from 5,000 to 25,000 signatures. As a result, the use of that project, the number of petitions and so forth, fell off exponentially through November, December, January, and so forth. I think in the first 45 days, they got something like 10,000 petitions. At one point, there were 300-400 of now, I think there's only 30-some petitions that are active at We the People, at WhiteHouse.gov. They've given a total of 81 responses. And so all of the heat that was generated, all of the interest and the huge amount of traffic just fell off. It was almost as if the White House really didn't want the project to grow. They wanted it to die out really quickly. So it's still there. WhiteHouse.gov, and then go to We the People. But too late. The disclosure petition had made it in, and it got a response from the White House. That response was historical for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is that it was the first time in history that the executive branch of the U.S. government had put a petition position in writing regarding the extraterrestrial issue. They had steadfastly avoided doing that for good reasons. They don't want to engage. They don't want anything happening. The Air Force the Air Force basically feels the same way, which is why they closed out the investigations, supposedly, with Blue Book in 69, and since then have been issuing this blanket statement that they no longer investigate this phenomenon. And whatever it is, they don't investigate, it doesn't pose a threat. They never outright say. The Air Force never outright says there's no extraterrestrial presence. Well, the White House maybe didn't get the memo on that because on November the 4th, in a response to the petition calling for the president to the White House wrote about a 9-paragraph response from a staffer of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the OSTP, which is the science office for the president. And in that response, they stated right up front, the U.S. government has no evidence that any life exists outside our planet or that an extraterrestrial presence has contacted or engaged any member of the human race. In addition, there is no credible information to suggest that any evidence is being hidden from the public's eye. And it goes on with a few things that are not significant. And then repeats this statement, in other words, later on. The second reason that this is historical, well, or important, is that it's false. It's demonstrably false, and millions of people know it to be false on reading it. And thirdly, and this is not a distinction without a difference, it's indefensible. You can be wrong and able to defend your wrongness, happens all the time, for whatever reason, able to make your case, you're able to defend against those who would challenge your statement. That would be a defensible breaking a statement. This is not defensible, meaning that if any member of the White House would dare to walk on a stage and debate that paragraph with any of the better researchers or activists in this field, they wouldn't have a chance. So, well, as of November the 4th of last year, we have this extraordinary statement by the White House, which they can't defend, and so the idea was to go after that statement and to do it publicly so the press could sort of see what's going on. So the next thing we did was file, actually not once but twice, Disclosure Petition 2, drawing attention to the Rockefeller Initiative, which was the effort by the billionaire friend of the Clintons, Lord Rockefeller, to get all the files released, to get amnesty for any witnesses that came forward out of the military, the intelligence community, to end the truth embargo, basically, and make Clinton the disclosure president. It went on for 3 years. So we drew attention to that. There was no chance we would get 25,000 signatures. I think it got 4 or 5. Claimed on the White House website for the minimum 30 days. That was followed by disclosure petition 3, nuclear weapons tampering, which drew attention to the witness testimony coming forward from high-level, former, now-retired members of the Air Force who work in nuclear operations with high security clearance. A number of those witnesses gave a press conference at the National Press Club, and they're all part of a larger context of nuclear tampering that's being researched by Robert Hastings, an excellent researcher. He's written an extremely important book called UFOs and Nukes. So that was the third petition. In other words, we're saying, you say there's no evidence, what about this? But again, there was no way to get a second response from the White House, because they'd increased the threshold to 25,000 signatures and reduced dramatically the amount of activity at that project site, thus minimizing the number of crossover signatures. Which brings us to, of course, Chase Brandon. So he became disclosure petition 4. And the upshot there, right, is as follows, and let me read the petition as it reads, and is up on the White House website right now. Let me grab this now. Oops. Go here, and here, and then I got to go here. Okay. Let me bring it up. I've got the wrong one.
It's a beautifully drafted petition. Open memo. So to this open memo, very eloquent, strong arguments.
Yes, and I'll get to that, certainly. Here's the petition that's up there right now. We petition the Obama administration to investigate assertions by CIA agent Chase Brandon of an extraterrestrial explanation for the 1947 Roswell events. The recent statements by former senior CIA agent Chase Brandon confirmed the testimony of dozens of first and second-hand witnesses to the extraterrestrial nature of the events during early July 1947 at and near Roswell, New Mexico. These testimonies directly contradict the President's Office of Science, Technology and Biology statement, the U.S. government has no evidence, et cetera, et cetera. The extraterrestrial truth embargo is now inappropriate policy, which undermines the credibility of the United States. And that's the fourth disclosure petition drawing upon Chase Brandon. All right, that was the first maneuver. It has about 360 signatures. Don't really care how many signatures it gets because, again, it cannot possibly reach 25,000. But it will be on the White House website for all to see from around the world through August the 10th. Now, step two was, how to further draw attention to Brandon. And that brings me to the Roswell trio. Because what Chase Brandon, represented was the hat trick for testimony regarding the extraterrestrial nature of the Roswell event. Let me remind your audience that the government, particularly the Air Force, has always felt that Roswell was the weakest link in the truth disclosure the truth embargo chain. They've always been worried about it because of the number of witnesses that had pieces of the story, the number that, obviously, many still living, particularly as of the early 90s, many still living, the number that had been interviewed by people like Stan Friedman, Moore, Donald Schmidt, Kevin Randall, and others in the late 70s, 80s, and 90s. So there's all this testimony out there that when you look at it and bring it together, makes fairly clear that there were extraterrestrials in a crashed vehicle in Roswell in 47. And obviously that, if that were to coalesce, that's the end of the truth embargo. And this is the reason why the Air Force has gone to such lengths to protect that flank of the truth embargo with a number of statements which are ludicrous to try to explain it. The initial explanation of it being a raw wind weather balloon, and then they held out pieces of a cork walk wind weather balloon in a press conference on July the 8th of 1947, which, of course, was bogus. Then they came back with another explanation right around the same time that a book was about to be published, and this was the mobile balloon explanation, which puts the lie to the press conference on July the 8th, because they weren't showing mobile balloon there. But they're saying, well, we were showing a fake. We showed another balloon to cover up the fact that the real balloon was the problem, and it was a special nuclear weapons launch testing balloon and blah, 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 and that the bodies that people claimed to have seen were crash test dummies, which we learned would not even drop until 1952. I mean, that, and they held a press conference in the Pentagon in front of a lot of press that ended up laughing at them. But, so naturally that, they didn't keep the record of that press conference around much, or they certainly haven't handed it out. You can't find it because obviously it's embarrassing. Well, the reason they've gone to those lengths, because they haven't done that with any other case, is because Roswell has been a major problem for them and always has been. Even though so many have died off, the majority of witnesses have died off. So with that in mind, what's happened since 1997 is this. Colonel Philip Perso, Jr., who served in the Korean War in World War II as an intelligence officer, 20-year distinguished career, then on, and during which he was the number two man at the Army's Foreign Technology Desk. The number one guy was Trudeau. This is a small desk, not as big as the one at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Air Force Foreign Technology Desk. He also worked as a staffer on President Eisenhower's National Security Staff. He was also a staffer on the Warren Commission. This is a distinguished man, and he decided in the last years of his life to write some memoirs, and a book was written by Bill Burns off of an internal memoir that he had been writing for many years. And in this book, and in subsequent interviews that he had, many hours of interviews of Philip Perso exist, only a small percentage, a minority, have been shown to the public. He made statements, but some of these are notable, and they are as follows. On or about July the 6th, 1947, while stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas, I, Philip Perso, Senior Lieutenant Colonel, personally observed a 4-foot non-human creature with bizarre-looking four-fingered hands, thin legs and feet, and an oversized incandescent light bulb-shaped head. The eye sockets were oversized and almost shaped, almond-shaped, and pointed down to its tiny nose. I personally have read the medical autopsy reports, which refer to the autopsy of the previously described creature that I saw in 1947 at Fort Riley, Kansas. In 1961, I came into possession of what I refer to as the Roswell file. This file contains field reports, medical autopsy reports, and technological debris from the crash of an extraterrestrial vehicle in Roswell, New Mexico, in 1947. In other interviews, you know, he's made it clear that he came into that file while working at the Foreign Technology Desk, and they tried to see some of the ideas that were had been gleaned from studying that craft to the commercial technology areas in the United States that were appropriate to see if it would help give the U.S. An edge. How much of an edge it may have provided is highly debatable, but he stated quite unequivocally that that's what he did. And then he made another statement in an interview which has become kind of well-known. He stated, I had the evidence that a crash did happen here in Roswell. Give this information to the young people of the world and this country they want. Give it to them. Don't hide it and tell lies and make stories. They're not stupid. It's their information. It doesn't belong to the Army or the Department of Defense. If it's classified, take the classification off and give it to them. So this was the contribution of Philip Corso, which you mentioned before, 1998, when he passed away from heart difficulties. And it made a lot of press. The book sold a lot of copies. It was sold out of the Pentagon bookstore for several years, moving rather briskly. He did interviews and so forth. But overall, there achieved a critical mass, and obviously the truth embargo continued on. Now we come to Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Right at the end of Corso's life, in 1997, just before he died, and not that long after Corso had come out confirming Roswell as an ET craft, Navy Captain Dr. Edgar Mitchell, who as a NASA lunar pilot, commanded the, he was the pilot on the Apollo 14 mission, and he was the sixth man of the 12 to walk on the moon. He has a PhD from MIT in aeronautics and astronautics. He's a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, that was in 1970, and the U.S. Navy Distinguished Medal, and a number of honorary documents. This is a serious man. In 1997, he made the decision to step forward publicly, perhaps motivated by Corso. Don't know. I should ask him. And make a number of statements like this one, right? I've talked with people of stature, of military and government credentials and position, and heard their stories, and their desire to tell their stories openly to the public. And that got my attention very, very rapidly. The firsthand experiences of these credible witnesses that, now in advanced years, are anxious to tell their story, we can't deny that. And the evidence points to the fact that Roswell was a real incident, and that indeed an alien craft did crash, and that material was recovered from the crash site. He has been stating this, in one way or another, continuously since 1997. That is 15 years. And on occasion, it's made news. And there was a news cycle that might last for a couple of weeks. One of the other things that he talks about is that, and this is one of the interesting coincidences, I think, of the 20th century, is that this man who ends up walking on the moon was, most of his childhood, raised in Roswell, New Mexico. So when he comes back from the moon, a hero, right, a highly distinguished American, right, remember, he gets the Medal of Freedom in 1970, there were a number of people in Roswell that wanted to talk with him, that did talk with him. And I believe that a number of these people had never spoken to any of the researchers. In other words, they didn't want to talk with researchers. They didn't want to get into the whole controversy. But Edgar was one of them, and he was a NASA astronaut hero. And so I think they confided in him off the record. Their account. So he got some excellent testimony, which he's aware of all the other research and so forth, from some first-hand people. And so here we have Edgar Mitchell saying Roswell was an ET craft. But did that create a critical mass? No, it did not. And they have managed to keep them at bay in a way. And then, of course, a few weeks ago, comes Chase Brandon. And here is a couple of things that he said in these interviews. It was a vaulted area at CIA headquarters, and not everybody could get in. One day I was looking around in there and reading some of the titles. There's one box that really caught my eye. It had one word on it, Roswell. I took the box down, lifted the lid up, rummaged around inside, and put the box back on the shelf and said, "My God, it really happened." The box contains some written material and some photographs, and that's all I will ever say to anybody about the content of that box. But it absolutely, for me, was the single validating moment that everything I had believed and knew, that so many other people believed would happen, truly was what occurred. It, meaning Roswell, was not a damn weather balloon. It was what it was billed when people first reported it. It was a craft that clearly did not come from this planet. It crashed, and I don't doubt for a second that the use of the words remains and cadavers was exactly what people were talking about. This then becomes the third significant person from the military intelligence world to acknowledge ET reality of Roswell. This is the hat trick. And so what just happened as of this morning, you're the first interview where I've been talking about this. PRG broadly publicized, in fact, that would go on for the next day or two, across the internet and so forth, the usual methodologies, an open memo to President Obama. And I will read this for your audience, but they can see this memo at the Examiner. All right, just do a search on open memo to President Obama. It's up in the Examiner. And it's up at the Paradigm Research Group website, and it will be out on several press releases and news releases here later today, and it'll turn up elsewhere. But it reads as follows. Your audience will be able to see that we're trying to create a critical mass regarding Roswell, and Chase Brandon is the final piece of the puzzle, hopefully. And so it says, Mr. President, there is a matter before you which calls out for your attention regarding events at or near Roswell, New Mexico in July 1947. Please consider the following. And then there follows, again, the testimonies from Corso, Mitchell, and Brandon, along with their key credentials. All right? And that's pretty much what I just read to you. So that follows. And then after comes this. Mr. President, how many long-serving members of the military services and civilian agencies you command have to come forward before your administration tells the truth to the American people about an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race? The embargo on acknowledgement of these truths was forced in the furnace of the Cold War between 1947 and 1952. The nation faced the real prospect of a nuclear Third World War. The government needed time to understand the extraordinary developments unfolding. Few would question this decision. Cold War lasted 44 years and nearly ended civilization. Acknowledging an extraterrestrial presence with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons on a launch on warning basis was too great a risk. But the Cold War has been over for two decades, and the policy of truth embargo is no longer appropriate. It is helping to undermine the credibility of the United States and contributing to the decline of trust in government and media, currently at near record lows. This can't go on. It is time for you to designate a representative within or near to the White House to meet with representative classified committees within the military intelligence complex that manage extraterrestrial-related issues. They would meet to seek agreement on the act of disclosure. What assurances do the military services and intelligence agencies need to take this momentous step? What assurances does the White House need to access as to access to the information and evidence that support and confirm the act of disclosure? There is no time for further delay. If one of your advisors implores you to wait because, quote, this issue is just too big to engage during the election year, reject that advice. The American people have made it clear an election year is precisely the time to engage the big, most difficult issues. They want to know the thinking and intentions of the politicians who aspire to lead them. They want to participate in the reality of government in their lives. They are tired of the lies and misinformation only to be told the truth of the matter after the consequences of policy are already manifest. Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso could not have said it better. Give the disinformation people in the world, in this country, they want it. Give it to them. Don't hide it and tell lies and make stories. They're not stupid. It's their information. It doesn't belong to the Army or the Department of Defense. If it's classified, take the classification off and give it to them. Respect to Stephen Bassett, Executive Director. And then there's a few links regarding Corso, Mitchell, and Brandon. So I think you can see, Patrice, that the attempt here is now to focus the media's attention again on Roswell and these three men and ask themselves, is it conceivable that a long-serving career intelligence officer who served in two wars that a PhD from MIT NASA Apollo module pilot who walked on the moon and a 40-year senior officer from the CIA would all concoct false stories that Roswell was not a mobile balloon, but an ET craft. Is it conceivable? And if it is not, then the biggest story in history is parked right under the hairs in their nostrils. And when are they going to do their job? So that's what's happening right at this particular time, and I hope your audience will spread the word, right? Spread this, the link to this open letter, and the link to the petition, and so forth.
Both the disclosure for and that open memo to President Obama are beautifully drafted, very strong arguments. Thank you so much, Steve, for reading those out loud to the audience and describing to them the different elements. I had asked you to do so, and I very much appreciate it. And I'm, to me, it's an honor to have you on my show. Anyway, let's get back to a bit of a, could we term it a media storm on this? For example, I was rather impressed by that BBC July 15th Stephen Nolan interview with Mr. Brandon. Chase Brandon really seemed to hold his own during that interview. And, you know, I hope I'm not just a gullible little old lady, but I was really receiving a very strong impression that he knows there's an ET presence. During his years of service with the CIA, apparently he had some opportunity to visit sites with ancient monuments that he was wondering just how they could have been constructed. He himself believed that Roswell very well could be the case. I was just very impressed as to veracity and to his convictions, and as to his convictions.
Well, yeah, he's a very gregarious man. He talked to Blue Street. You know, CIA operatives are extremely smart. You don't get to be
yes,
a mainstream covert operative, the CIA, that's very, very smart. But he has a certain quality, which is why you could see that they would have selected him to be the liaison to the entertainment industry when they set up that office for the first time. I don't know who that person is now. I probably should check. But it's also notable, let's go back to the very first statement I made about him, that he's written a book called Cryptos Get Under, which is about Roswell and covering it up. So he's doubled down there. Remember, I believe it's true. I'm writing a fiction book about it. I think I'm sure people are going to read that book and try to read between the lines and see if it's referring to, in a fictional manner, things that really happened. But obviously the immediate point has been made by a number of individuals that no, he's just doing, all of this is just a promotional step to sell this book. Well, that's possible. Anything is possible. But highly, highly unlikely. Well, first of all, when you're a CIA agent, particularly a covert agent, you never really retire from the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
You're in for life, anyway. And so the idea that someone who's on a full pension, too, of course, from the CIA, would lie about documents that they claim to have seen inside Langley, the CIA headquarters, and lie about the truth about Roswell, meaning he knows it's not an extraterrestrial vehicle, but he, you know, that doesn't help him sell the story, in order to sell a book is almost inconceivable. It would be extremely risky behavior. It would be wide open and could be embarrassed very, very easily. It would be disloyalty to the agency. So it's just, to me, a very, very slim possibility. There are only four possibilities. One is that he has completely created this from whole cloth, and it's just to sell his book, it's all a lie. Two, that he is not telling the truth, but he's doing it at the request of the CIA, meaning that this is a disinformation action. All right. Three, that it is all true, and he decided to talk about his story because it's 2012. He's retired, and he does have a book coming out. So it was a good time to say this, because he hadn't talked about it before. And he didn't notify the CIA that he was going to do that. He just did it on his own. Now, I've already confirmed, got some, a secondary confirmation, that his book, which is always the case, but I did get it confirmed by a colleague, that the book was reviewed by the CIA. So they knew the book was coming out, I remember.
Their public relations board, yes.
Absolutely. But he didn't tell them he was going to tell this story. And the fourth possibility is that he did tell them he was going to do this story. And they obviously said no problem. And there's a variation on that one where, in fact, they came to him and said, we want you to tell your story. We want this out. That's the most interesting. That could be the most serious one. Now, as the first one, the first possibility, total lie, to me, there's a less than 1% chance that's true. The second one, that it's a deliberate lie the CIA has requested to be put out, is a little more, is slightly more possible, but not much. As disinformation, this is awful. I mean, just awful. The last thing you would want to do to service the truth embargo is to create misinformation like this, where a officer, a senior officer, comes out and flatly says to Boswell what he did. That's not misinformation. That's like shooting yourself in the foot. So I doubt it. The third possibility that he just decided it's time to tell the story, the book that he didn't tell him about, this particular anecdote that he was going to talk about, that's more likely. It's possible. But the most likely, surely, is that he greenlighted the book. He told him that he was going to talk about his belief in Roswell as fact, and also that he had seen these records, and they either agreed to it, or even encouraged him to do this. That is the most likely scenario here. Now, whether the press can figure this out, I don't know. I've been overestimating them of late, but you never know. They may find their legs. But if the fourth one is true, this is highly significant. Because what it implies to me, that it has all the earmarks of what is called a limited hangout.
Yes.
And this is when a government agency, particularly ones that are covert or that operate with classifications, will put something out that is true regarding something, a particular matter. But they don't put out much. It's just something that would generate some interest, attract some attention. They will put it out for any number of reasons. They may not back it up either. They may not say anything else. And they'll do it, for one, to gauge the reaction to it, see how people respond, how the media responds, so they can garner information from that reaction. Another reason is because they want to protect their flank. They want to demonstrate that they have been providing information about something and therefore may hope to accuse them of being overly complicit in the withholding of important information from the American people. So it's essentially a flanking move in a way. And this has all the earmarks of that. And then that brings us to the punchline for me, which is why now? Why do you make this maneuver now? Just because it's convenient? Just because this guy's writing a book and what the hell? Let's just throw this into the mix. I would doubt that. I think the most compelling explanation for this event is that the CIA, which after all is the intelligence gathering agency for the president, and by this personal intelligence, human intelligence, and so forth, purely electronic intelligence is focused within the NSA, the National Security Agency. But the CIA has the role, and most people understand, it's not a large agency. But they kind of, their business is to know what the hell's going on. And obviously the place is riddled with individual security clearances who are able to talk to individuals in government that other people can't talk to about subjects other people can't talk about. And so it's quite possible that the CIA is aware that disclosure of the extraterrestrial presence is very close at hand. And as a result, this they consider to be a good maneuver, a limited hangout maneuver to protect their flank and try to improve their post-disclosure image. And while I don't list it in the open letter to Obama, if you go and listen, and they're on the internet now, they're on YouTube, they're over at Coast to Coast AM, but if you go and listen to the two interviews that Brandon gave to Wells and to George Norrie, particularly the George Norrie interview, there is a very important
pause
interview toward the end.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does is he makes it, I'm paraphrasing here, he says what is maybe more important or very equally important is what was not in the box. And then he drifted off into something else, and then he came back to it. You could tell he wanted to make sure he got this out. And the saying is, what was not in the box was anything that intimated that the CIA was involved in any conspiracy to withhold evidence from the American people or as an orchestrated larger process of, quote, being complicit with the truth embargo. He said that a couple of times. And the point he's making here is one that's been made before. The CIA's job is to gather intelligence, not to create programs. The White House decides what's going to be done with the intelligence. Their job is just to collect it. Their job is not to say, here's what we found, now here's what we need to tell the American people. The White House decides what the American people are going to want. And so, now we know that there have been serious problems over the last 34 years. The CIA is involved in a lot of proactive covert programs. And so, this is all to be sorted out at another time. But he's essentially trying to, protecting the CIA's image and position on this issue should disclosure take place. It is very obvious, and that is the reason, in a sense, if the CIA is involved here, if they have encouraged him or even asked him to do this, that it is those statements that is the most important to them, the agency, that Chase Brandon is making all over the place, and he is not done. So now I think your audience may be starting to see that this is not just another event. That this is, or just another witness coming forward with another little story that you add to the huge pile, hoping that one day some press will walk in and look at the pile. Now there's something else that happened, which is not directly connected, but it's not. And that is that just a few days after Chase Brandon was on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, the United Kingdom released another set of UFO files, 25 files with about 6,000 pages. What happened, interestingly enough, is that Chase Brandon was getting a lot of coverage around the world, and again, these articles are archived at ParadigmResearchGroup.org in the media archive, and picking up steam, right, and on its way to a pretty good news cycle, and all of a sudden the UK released these files, and that story took over, and shut down the Chase Brandon story for the time being. That went on for a while. Even much more coverage of this around the world. It always happens when the UK makes these releases. But it sort of put the exclamation point on the sentence. Here's more evidence, more stuff turning up, more stuff being put out into the public domain to be downloaded on millions of computers all over the world. Evidence that the United States government's Office of Science and Technology Policy, the White House rather, Office of Science and Technology Policy, says doesn't exist at all. The truth embargo could break at any moment. I'm not predicting the day or the time, but I'm telling you it could break at any time. And a lot of agencies, the Air Force, CIA, the Navy, the Army, of course, are going to be asked a lot of very tough questions. that's unavoidable. And I'm sure none of them are looking forward to that, and they're very concerned about how they are going to fare in a disclosure event and in a post-disclosure context. By the way, I had a colleague send me an email after I put out the petition, and he made this note that because I was making the point that, again, Chase Brandon's testimony about Roswell was, again, another contradiction of the OSTP's position, or the White House's position by the OSTP. And the colleague mentioned that wasn't the only thing that his testimony contradicted. Quite true. Because his testimony, as is the case with Mitchell and Corso, essentially kicks the Air Force's mogul balloons in the behind. The Air Force has been adamant that it was a mogul balloon. They gave a press conference. They had a book published. They have stuck with that story through thick and thin since 1997. And these three men, particularly Brandon now, are basically saying it's bogus. It's a lie. There's no way it's an accident. There's no way that they mixed it up. The Air Force is outright lying. So now you have a career officer within the CIA saying that the Air Force is lying about probably the most important event of the 20th century or any other century. This is awkward. Do you know what I mean? This is awkward. Now, the Air Force hasn't responded yet. The CIA has already been queried by Grant Cameron and Victor Vigiani and Richard Dolan, and all that's in place. And so far, the response from the CIA has been very, I would just say, sparse.
Well, cordial, too. And not saying that the gentleman was a liar in any respect, but they've not located that material. I'm very widely paraphrasing.
In fact, if you look at that, it's almost exactly what Corso and the Army and the DOD. They never issued some lengthy rebuttal of Corso. They didn't attack him. They didn't ridicule him. Sure, they got asked lots of questions, and I think they gave some very, very limited responses. Their attitude was, we don't want to talk about this. This is the last thing we want to talk about, so let's just pretend it's not there. Let's just say as little as possible, and as long as the press is going to continue to stay in the tank on this issue and not do their job, then we will continue on. What can I say? That's exactly what they did, and the CIA at this point looks to be doing or attempting to do the same thing. By the way, at the same time, the Air Force was not making any efforts to either discredit or fundamentally show that Corso was completely a puppet nut. Mm-hmm. They couldn't sell the book fast enough in the Pentagon bookstore. So this is the funny thing side of this. I mean, this is really not funny. I mean, it's as serious as a heart attack, but you have to laugh at how absurd are the positions that agencies like the CIA and the Army and the Air Force and White House have been put in by this truth embargo, which just no longer is supportable. It's making fools out of pretty much everybody, one way or another. So, again, that's where we are with this, Patrice, and I'm going to do everything I can to make Chase Brandon as famous as possible.
Well, he's certainly highly credentialed. He has served our country, and he also has a fine new position. I guess he's still, would you call him a consultant to the CIA or contract employee? But he also now works in that. I've got two questions to ask you. Sure. Here in the article by Robbie Graham and Matthew Alford, Ph.D., entitled Senior CIA Officer Claims Knowledge of Roswell Alien Cover-Up, they note that he presently has a fine position as senior consultant to Spectel. This is quotes, the Intelligence Division of Defense giant BAE Systems, end quote. So, highly gifted individual. But
I'm
two questions.
Sure that he probably is on call. He could end up getting jobs providing consulting to movies. You know, there have been a couple of ET movies produced in the last few years. So, all of this, he puts at risk by blatantly lying about Roswell files with the CIA and his belief of the subject and so forth. He puts it all at risk to sell a few books, to become famous? What? No. Again, everyone's looking for the explanation. Those people who just can't bear the thought that Roswell was extraterrestrial will look for whatever they can to somehow justify their feeling on that, but they're going to lose. Roswell was an extraterrestrial craft. That's it. And that's the most important event of the 20th century, perhaps. And it's one of the most difficult problems for government, because all of the sightings, all of the other evidence, whether it's crop circles or trace cases or even abductions, the government could, and sort of has, take the position that, you know, there may be something going on, but we're as in the dark as you are. I mean, we're as baffled as you are. This is the position that John Alexander has repeated many times. So, you know, hang with us, right? I mean, we're not going to tell you there's any danger, because we don't really know, but yeah, there's really something going on, and we wish we knew something about it. Well, they really do take that position in various ways. Roswell blows that out of the water. Roswell is, they got a craft in their possession, which they've obviously researched and studied to death, and they had dead alien bodies, and some believe they had one living alien body. So that completely destroyed the whole idea that, well, we're as much in the dark as you. And so Roswell is the weakest link in the truth embargo, and that link could break at any time, even though it's now, my Lord, 65 years since it happened. Nevertheless, as you can see, there's plenty of documents out there. There are children of firsthand witnesses, and there are men like Corso and Mitchell and Brandon who have the willingness, the courage, to step forward and speak the truth to power. And so one of the reasons that I pressed this issue with the White House so much is that the White House has an enormous amount of, if this story is forced on them, meaning a series of, a cascading series of events take place, kind of like what happened to Bill Clinton, and the whole thing gets out of control, and there's nothing they can do, and the next thing you know, they're having to give a press conference to an announced ET president. There's enormous damage that could be done to them, and it gets even worse if another country steps forward in front of their people. There are some other countries out there, in case we haven't forgotten, and they make the announcement. That's even worse for the White. And so I'm trying to help. I'm just saying, take the bull by the horns, get the job done, and many accolades and rewards will rain down upon you. Don't get the job done. Let it blow up in your face or be done by another country, and you will not be happy. So I'm trying to be a patriot here. What can I say? A little patriot, part of Steve, bubbling up. Will they do it? Well, you know the record of the U.S. government over the last 45 years. If they can get their pants mourning with the zipper in the right place and get the garbage taken out, they feel like they've had a great day. And then they go home and chill out. It's just not good. And the issues facing us and the implications of some of these issues are staggering. This is not a good time. You know, it's like the World Series has come, and everybody at the team that used to be batting 310 are now batting 110. I mean, nobody can hit the ball. Nobody can get on base. It is striking out day after day. The fans are upset. They're screaming. They're throwing, you know, bobblehead dolls down on the field. They're yelling and so forth, and nobody's happy. I mean, that's kind of the situation, if you like your baseball analogies. George will, but that's it. I mean, it's not that much more complicated than that. Anybody in the White House who thinks that this truth embargo is locked down and that they can keep this going for a long time, they're smoking something, good quality something, because that is not the case, and they need to wake up in there and realize, you know, they have a chance to make history as opposed to being a victim.
Well said. And, you know, Steve, as far as international coverage on these matters and the fact that the Chase Brandon revelation is receiving such coverage, major coverage, you've got this very important to me article, July 12th, BBC News, that, quote, Prime Minister Tony Blair was briefed on the UK's files about UFO sightings in 1998, end quote. That's major. Mm-hmm. And also, I'd like your help with something here, Steve. Your coverage, as usual, with the Paradigm Research Group has been excellent on this development. So, too, has Grant Cameron's at his site, UFO presidential blog. Where is it? I have it right here. Pardon me. presidentialufo.com, Grant Cameron site. Now, Steve, I'm very widely paraphrasing here. Grant does have some questions about this revelation. Of course, there is the factor of the secrecy agreement, and Grant does make the good points that to have any key information found in this sort of disorganized or unprofessional fashion, and where it wasn't compartmentalized, to have that much verification, does pose a question. And also, though, again, I'm paraphrasing, in his interviews, both in the news media and on the air, Chase Brandon seems to be very hesitant to give any specific details. I guess that's to prevent him from in any way violating his secrecy agreement. He wouldn't want to violate his secrecy agreement. What do you think of those questions that this material was found in a very anomalous fashion?
Well, these are not inappropriate questions to raise, certainly. We are forced to guess at some of this because clearly he's saying so much and not anymore. But I can respond in some substance here. First of all, I invite everyone to go into his interview with George Norrie. You can, it's on YouTube, and of course it's at the Coast to Coast AM archive, right, which you can access for a few bucks a month.
Right.
Now he goes on and on. He just loves to talk, so it takes him forever to get to what he's trying to get to. But he gets to it, and it depends on which one you're looking at. But it's about an hour or so into the interview, and they finally get to the box, right, which is the story that really got everybody's attention. And when you listen to it a couple of times, you'll note that he goes to great lengths to explain why that material was. Remember, we're talking about inside the CIA. Very few people have been inside the CIA. They just think of it as, well, as a bunch of spooks and a bunch of super classified files and big giant safes and all kinds of security stuff. No, it's not that way. So he explains why that box could be where it was. And the room that he was in, the historical intelligence, was just one of a number of these kinds of things that were a class workplace in a somewhat library setting, and things could turn up. He also does state in one of the interviews that the material that he looked at his view was not classified. It was not marked classified. Now, he also made the point that, well, anything inside Langley is, by definition, classified. But what he was saying is we're not talking about some operation vault or some highly organized file arrangement containing classified documents so marked, that this is something else. Now, one of my colleagues has concluded, therefore, that all this box contained was some news articles, some stuff that was sent to the CIA by all the well-meaning ufologists out there over the years, trying to get them to pay attention, or maybe some guy just liked the subject and gathered a bunch of stuff and stuck it in his desk, which would tend to somewhat minimize Brandon's account. There's a certain logic to that, though frankly, if we're talking about nothing more than public domain magazine articles, you'd wonder why they would bother to keep them around. But also there is a logic here. He states, as I wrote, and maybe I should go back to that. He states that,
well, in the interim, I just want to say thank you. I find your explanations very helpful. I heard quite a few segments of interviews, but on a few I couldn't hear the entire interview. I really appreciate that. It's giving me a very good explanation.
It's tough to listen to because he does talk and talk and talk, but nevertheless, I am paraphrasing pretty well what happened. Yeah, let me read what he stated in the some of the statements he made in the Nori interview. The box contains some written materials and some photographs, and that's all I will ever say to anybody about the context of that box. But it absolutely, for me, was the single validation that everything I had believed and knew, but that so many other people believed and knew, truly was what occurred. Well, first of all, if it's just some magazine articles and some glossum that some worker there had gathered because they were interested or some stuff was sent in, it would have not particularly been a problem to say what it was. He could have said, yeah, I saw some magazine articles, one was from Time, one was whatever. That would not have been a problem. So he's implying that what it was still of a nature that he could not go into specific. And secondly, if it's simply public domain stuff that happened to be in the CIA somewhere, got stuck in a box and thrown into a library archive, hey, that stuff is out in the open. There is a vast quantity of information about Roswell all over the place, many, many books, huge amounts of internet material. So the idea that the fact that he just saw some innocuous material of that nature, and just because it was inside the CIA, that was confirming to him, but if he had seen it outside the CIA. So he is catching here, and you have to assume that he has a reason for it. So I'm not particularly troubled by that. As far as security clearances, well, you know, that's why they have to approve stuff. That's why when you write a book, you have to run it by the CIA to make sure that you haven't violated any security understandings. Or if you do, they're okay with that. Meaning, okay, this would be violating, this would be outside the protocols. In other words, you probably shouldn't say that. But in this case, for whatever reason, under the circumstances, that's all right. You're green-lighted on that. In other words, just because something's classified doesn't mean you can't get approval to release it. The agency can make that decision. And so maybe what he saw was of a nature that it would not normally be discussed because of its classified status. On the other hand, if he informed the CIA that he was going to tell this story as part of a promotion for his book, and they said, that's fine, then there's your answer. So far, again, these are reasonable questions to raise, but so far, nothing has come forward that makes me want to challenge the basics of this particular story with Brandon. Now, that could change. That could change. But so far, there's plenty there to run with, and of course, that's what PRT is doing. And again, we're going to try to make Chris Brandon as well known as possible. And if he sells a lot of books, more power to him.
Well, I'll tell you, at this point, I'd very much like to purchase The Cryptos Conundrum and also his second book, which I believe is named Hourglass, to come out within the next 16 to 18 months. I think that's mm-hmm. The second book. Also, and before I get to one of the individuals who is spamming the room, but he's a very good researcher, Sky Mon, before I get to his questions, Steve, do you think that there's any specific agenda date here, the 65th anniversary for this revelation, or is it just a great point for him to be publishing his new book?
Well, he clearly is timed the book release to marry up the 65th anniversary. No, nothing striking there. And he clearly, and I had one confirmation of this already, not that I really needed that, he clearly ran that book. In other words, the CIA has known about that book and has seen advanced copies of that book well before the present day. Right. He just didn't walk in there a week ago and say, hey, here's the book I'm going to do, what do you think? They've known about this for some time. So, one way to look at this, and this is just an assessment, this is just an educated guess, because again, we only have the information we have, is that it's 2012, the truth embargo is floundering, documents are being released, and it also is the 61st anniversary, fine, and this man is writing a book, and he is who he is gregarious, he is a spokesperson, he is clearly somebody who could, quote, represent the CIA's interest in the public domain, whatever those interests would be, and I'm suggesting that one of those interests is the CIA's need to make that possible image if the president announces the ET presence tomorrow. And knowing that he was going to do this book, knowing that this story, my guess is that he's told this story to a few people in the CIA. I can see why he might have sat on it as far as public statement, but that doesn't mean he had to sit on it inside the CIA. He tells himself stuff all the time. So the CIA knew about this story. And that he or they suggested that this would be a good time to bring that out. Not so he could sell lots of books, they could care less about that, but because the book gives him the opportunity to get the media attention, to make the media turn. He's going to be interviewed. It falls together very nicely. He doesn't have to go out of his way, and they could put this story out in a very comfortable and convenient way. It is a perfect confluence of variables for a limited hangout, right? And remember, yes, the CIA is in the business of complex strategy and role-playing and game-playing. They're masters of this. And so there's nothing particularly normal at all tying this all together and handling it this way. Now, would they have done this in 1997? Hell no. In 1997, well, actually, from 94 to 97, a few years after the end of the Cold War, with Rockefeller, you know, in the White House with his initiative and D.B. Scott Jones and the whole party there trying to move things forward with Clinton too soon, they were not desirous of advancing this issue or even coming forward and risk the truth embargo by any CIA activity. You know what CYA is. That was 97, and that's why they gave that press conference. And that's why they put out the mobile balloon, was to contain Corso. Well, that's my view. Someone wants to argue otherwise, they're welcome to. But they embarrassed themselves and went to some lengths because they were deeply concerned about Corso, not to mention the fact that it coincided with the 50th anniversary of Roswell, which was slated to, Time magazine estimated maybe 200,000 people. So the Air Force is looking at this and going, oh, God, Roswell could be huge. You get all this coverage, more witnesses coming forward. This thing could blow up, and Roswell would be a major problem for us. And that was 15 years ago. So would they have done it then? Absolutely not. But it's 15 years later. Boy, a lot has happened regarding the ET issue since 97. And so, whether it's the Catholic Church or the CIA, these entities are getting positioned on this issue to be looked on as favorably as possible when the big day comes.
You know, that sounds very plausible to me. Very good point elements there. Very good elements there in your argument, Steve. I have two questions coming in now from the room from our researcher, Sky Mon. Very informed, intelligent fellow. Mm-hmm. And, well, his first question, and this too, this immediately shows that he's perceptive. He'd like to know when your next X conference will be held in the D.C. area. Yours was the best series of conferences ever.
That's kind of you. Look, they had their moments. There were some strong conferences there, but we had problems too. They always lost money, and it's created a lot of problems with PRG. I still owe $36,000 for essentially the whole six conferences that essentially got to get paid at some point for PRG to go forward. But I don't know when the next S conference will be. If I had to guess, it will be after disclosure. The economic collapse underway, coupled with some other factors, resulted in the S conference 2010 basically failing and creating a lot of debt. So for that reason, there was no conference in 2011, and there wasn't one this year. So if I had to guess, I don't think it's going to be possible to put on the next conference prior to disclosure. Too many obstacles. Now, if major funding came into PRG, and Lord knows, we'd love to see that happen. I might be able to put one together next year, but I don't think about that right now. I'm focusing on continuing the advocacy work, raising enough funds to just keep going, basic funding, and trying to find a way to break through for larger funding in other areas. So my guess is that the next X conference will be after disclosure, which is kind of cool in a way. I think I can safely say that the next X conference 2013, if it's 4 or 5 months after disclosure, I predict it will be very well attended.
So would I, Andrew Evans' work for this field is absolutely outstanding. Thank you, Steve. So Sky Mon is mentioning to me that you know him. His first name is Ryan, and I'm sure he also thanks you for your excellent efforts in this field. His second question is a question for Steve, quote, what does he think of retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dick French's claims that he investigated UFO sightings and was ordered to debunk them. And right now I'm noting at the Open Mind site, let me just bring it right up here. Here it is. Mm-hmm. At openminds.tv, there is an article entitled, it's by Michael Klein, posted July 18th, quote, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel talks about investigating and debunking UFO sightings. Have you heard this? I have not. Thanks very much for that call out there, Sky Mon. And just to briefly quote the text I'm citing from this article, quote, a story made national headlines recently when a 35-year CIA veteran named Chase Brandon, came forward. A 35-year CIA veteran named Chase Brandon came forward and stated to Lee Spiegel of the Huffington Post that he viewed CIA-held documents confirming the Roswell incident was of extraterrestrial origin. End quote. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Mr. Brandon, having served his country for so many years. Now, new paragraph. Let's see. I'm jumping down. Quote, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dick French's 27 years of military experience has taken him around the world. End quote. Now, let's see. Now, he's saying that, quote, his career started, quote, his career started in the AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations, where he would conduct stakeouts to remove personnel who were breaking the military's code of conduct. French then moved on to pilot training school and later was put in the 6004th Air Intelligence Security Squadron, where it was his duty to investigate any reported UFO sighting. He would collect any photographic evidence, question witnesses on the size and shape of the object, its estimated capability, and any other occurrences that surround the sighting. Yeah. In the end, though, French claims that his superiors told him to debunk these sightings however he could. This position also allowed him to travel to many interesting UFO hotspots while meeting high-ranking officials. He even claims to have met Colonel Philip Corso, end quote. Well, interesting article.
Well, yes. Insertion. This just happened. It just serves my point. As it states there, he was in a AFOSI, which is Air Force Office of Special Investigation, or Special Information, whatever. I'll find that out. But, yeah, he was a part of a very important component of the truth embargo, which was, Air Force Office of Special Investigation, which is one of the ways they had to manage the embargo. And remember, the problem they had was they are trying to pretend that there's just no issue here with extraterrestrials, but the extraterrestrials are all over the damn place. This is a problem. It's not like, running a special bomber program underground and nobody knows about it. I mean, we're talking about trying to say that there's nothing going on here, and the ETs are flying here, and they're flying there, and they're contacting and abducting people and mutilating cows and generating crop circles. I mean, hell, they're more prominent than the Cirque du Soleil. So in all of this, the government has got to somehow pull off this extraordinary maneuver where it's able to generally keep the media, the Congress, and the people from thinking that this really is something. Not easy to do. And they use every technique they had, honed, you know, to a sharp edge by the Cold War's, you know, demand. Everybody knows that the intelligence agencies, and whether they be the civilian or in the military, they hire the top people. These are the smartest guys in the room, the smartest women in the room that go into these areas. And one of the key components was disinformation, misinformation, undermining the research efforts, undermining stories, misleading researchers and what have you. This is a dirtier area. And obviously those involved in ACLOPI and this work are a little bit more reluctant to come forward than, say, some of the NUC tampering witnesses. Because, you know, those people just saw extraordinary things they think the Congress know about. These men, and virtually all men, were directly involved in the truth embargo itself. So, the best known example of an APOCI person coming forward is Richard Doty. And not surprisingly, that's a mess. Right? But I think the reason it's a mess is because the people who work in those programs are extremely conflicted. And so it's awkward in a lot of ways. But nevertheless, he's an example of somebody with the APOC and come forward about that. And now French has come forward. Until I learn otherwise, I'm going to assume that he is saying exactly what he knows and that he is who he is. The longer we go, the later in the day this gets. The further from the Cold War we get, we're now 20 years out, and the older these people get, the likelihood of their coming forward grows every day. And there are many reasons for why they would come forward. Corso had his reasons, Mitchell had his. But I know that it's very likely that some of the people that were in the tour programs dealing with the truth embargo, a lot of them may choose to come forward because they want to get it off their conscience. They this is tricky because, as I've said many times, it's hard to second-guess the government on the decision they made to embargo this issue in 47 and 52 in that time frame. But the problem is, of course, that the truth embargo went on and on and on. And the longer it went on, the more lies it had to be told, the more disinformation had to be pumped out. And so over time, it sort of became increasingly awkward. And there's a lot of sentiment in the public that this was very wrong, and they're not happy about it. Now, I'm sure there are plenty of people that worked in the truth embargo that were quite content with what they did, and it was national security based, and they don't need to apologize to anybody. And I'm not suggesting that French is somebody not to apologize, but nevertheless, I think some may do it because, well, yeah, people are talking, it's truth about this, and this was my role, and they can speak to that role, and they can defend themselves, to some respect. They can put a personal face behind this. You know, there's a lot of demonization of government, agencies, and what have you, because of the things that are happening in the world and the way things are happening in American government. And a lot of these people, they don't feel they're demons, and I think they want to come forward and tell their story, even if they were on the proactive end of the truth embargo, or the proactive side of it. So I expect more Dick Frenches to come forward, not less. And I think that that's a good thing, and that by and large, we won't be that hard on them. I think they'll get a pretty good reception. And I suspect there were a few things done to service the truth embargo that were particularly nasty. And I would be surprised if anyone involved in that comes forward. Let sleeping dogs lie, as it were. But there were plenty of things done in service of the truth embargo that were just part of the strategy, authorized under the National Security Act. They were doing their job. And I think you'll see some forward. But they are a different kind of witness than the other typical witnesses that are coming forward. But clearly, witnesses that come forward that were involved in the truth embargo itself, that's extremely supportive of what we know about what has happened. And I think the media will be intrigued by them. And I think they can get some strong attention because they're somewhat acting against their own interests. There's a bit more of a sexy story there. But Doty did not get much action, certainly. The press is not really focused on him. Maybe French will. But one thing is for sure, every witness that comes forward, the truth embargo weakens some more. And if the floodgates could open at any time, because I can assure you there are a ton of people that have been connected to this issue, still alive, that would love to tell their story. But they just not have felt that they could. The timing was right. They had too many obligations, a thousand things. But would love to, and as time goes by, they're more and more of them are reached position where they can, and they will.
Beautifully said. And, Steve, again, Skymon or Ryan, and again, it gives you a hello, is saying that this individual actually held the record for combat missions in the Air Force, and that's certainly very commendable. Thank you again for your excellent questions there, Skymon. And also, I'm thinking of a revelation. Is rather a recent one, I think, and that is by Greg Bishop, author of the great book, Project Beta, and that is as to the identity of a new Falcon, that being Harry Rosicky, and I guess he is a OSS and CIA veteran. So that's an interesting story as well, and again, that falls right, that segues into what you've said, that indeed many individuals are coming forward now.
Well, that's that'll be fun. The whole aviary thing is fun. When I looked into it, the sense I got is that at different times, different people were the same bird.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
It's like somebody would be a particular bird, and then they kind of drop out, and then later somebody come in, and they end up being that same bird. I mean,
right.
So there could have been more than one Falcon.
Exactly. I think that's what they're saying. That was it first Doty, but now it's other individuals coming forward to say that he is the Falcon, or...
This was not a formalized group. They didn't have a board of directors and minutes and a mission statement, and they weren't keeping track of everything. So
true.
This was just a way to... I think the bird stuff was in a way for fun. I think maybe for a couple of people they were literally trying to use it for creating some level of anonymity, but I'm not saying that the aviary was not important and that it's a significant part of the history. I think it is. But these fellows were having some fun too, and so who was what, whatever. But what the real story is, who were the people? There have always been people who have inside connections, who have worked on both, with any inside, any outside, whether it be in and out of intelligence or in and out of the military, who have communicated on the subject going back well before the internet, who are not going to come forward, but they were aware, interested, but they kept their engagement confined within certain parameters because they had other things in their life. They weren't going to give themselves over to the UFO issue, the ET issue. But they're smart, connected people, and they're communicating about this as they follow things along. It's been going on, I think, forever. We may never know all the people that were on this or the roles that they played in the history of this. beyond, say, just keeping in touch, you know, over the fence gossip. Did they do anything proactive? But clearly there was a need to keep in touch and embed information, and they did this amongst themselves. But the number of players, the number of involved people in this issue in history is still way above what we know. The actual number is a fairly substantial number. And another reason why the truth embargo is vulnerable, always vulnerable, because this is not a totalitarian state, and we generally don't toss people into dungeons or gulags because they speak out of turn. So a lot of interaction did take place. And we will not, hopefully there will be enough documentation and enough living parties that in a post-disclosure era, which hopefully will be extremely soon, we will be able to get a fairly good picture of the whole history, or most of it, and the people involved, because it would just be a tragedy if it were lost to us. This is the biggest event in human history. This is the most important in the world. All due respect to all the other important positions, and any history that's lost about this is bad. It's just a shame. Not that we haven't lost huge pieces of history in the past. There's a huge amount that we don't know about the whole history of the human experience. And in many cases, documents and records and libraries have been destroyed, thrown away. And that's life. That's just the way it is. But that doesn't mean we have to continue that way. And so while I regret the loss of the Alexandria Library, there are even more important things than that that we've lost, I think. And this issue particularly worries me. It's always worried me that the whole nature of the clandestine world and the nature of the truth embargo lends itself to losing history here. Documents destroyed, people taking their stories to the grave, their family destroying their memoirs. However, I've had enough discussions with enough people to know that there are a lot of memoirs in the hands, widows and sons and daughters in the file, some of which are known to them and some of which haven't been found yet, but they're there. And they will one day emerge, and you'll have historians just going through that stuff with a fine-tooth comb and reading about the history of the truth embargo and the ET reality as seen from the inside by these people. I think there are a lot of those out there, and some are emerging. But I'm always hearing stories about other potential documents and other memoirs that could very well eventually be obtained and come out. So post-disclosure world, as I've said many times, is going to be anything but dull.
Excellent point, Steve. And also, lest we forget, you'll be speaking at the Malta International Conference 2012. Is that this fall? This autumn?
Malta. Well, you know something I don't know. I'm not aware of that. I am speaking at this Pennsylvania MUFON PA conference in late September, I think September 29.
Excellent.
Sure. And right now, A.J. Gavard is trying to put together a major South American summit for November. And I'm waiting to hear about that. But if that goes down, it could be along the lines of like the European summit that was held in Barcelona.
Yes.
I might be down there. That would be my first trip to South America. That would be in November.
And this past year, this past year in South America in, is it Cotumba? It sounded
like no, that got canceled.
Oh, okay.
That was being sponsored by the city there. You know how that got, and it just didn't work out. So that was canceled.
The economy. Mm-hmm. Final word, Steve. It has been a pleasure to have you as a guest this evening. Excellent information. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Well, as always, Patrice, I know I talk too much, but hopefully listeners got some info. I would invite them to if they want to learn about the petitions, all of them, including the current one, they just need to go to disclosurepetition.info. They can also find the petition by going to whitehouse.gov and We the People, and it's one of the top petitions on the open section right there. You can find it pretty easily. We'll take all the signatures we can get. That's fine. And then if they go to paradigmresearchgroup.org, they will, I think, like the flash page there, the initial flash page. And then they can go into the site, and the next page they can see links, quick links to the media archive, and they can see the stories, not only Brandon, but also the story on the last UK file release, which included the thing about Tony Blair. Every time the UK releases files, there's always a couple of juicy ones in there, right? A lot of it's standard stuff. There's always a couple of juicy ones. Keep the fire going.
Right.
And all due respect to Nick Pope, I don't think this is an accident. I don't think they're just cleaning out their files. They are couple times a year for the last 5 years, almost 6 years, have been releasing these files, and every time it generates hundreds of news stories around the world. Trust me, that is not helping the truth embargo, right? It is making it much tougher on the truth embargo, but it makes the United Kingdom look good. So Catholic Church, CIA, United Kingdom, it's all positioning, right? Nobody wants to look bad when at the ball, at the big ball. And so disclosure will launch a new era in history. It will be hugely important. It will be a big deal, and nobody wants to show up for the event in old beat-up jeans and flip-flops with their hair scraggly. They want to be looking as good as they can. And so whether you're the Catholic Church or the CIA or maybe even the Air Force, I wouldn't want to be SETI. I don't think there's any redemption there at all. Or the CIA, you want to start getting your act together now. And I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing it with Stephen Hawking. We're seeing it with the London Royal Society of London. Entities that are taking measures and doing things which, if disclosure takes place, will put them in good light as trying to sort of engage the issue, showing that they're open to bringing information out, that they're not locked into some, quote, conspiracy of lies, whatever. Now, is it possible that this may work? I mean, just because you try to, but doesn't mean it's going to sell. So the public may see past that and go, no. You're not getting away with it that easy. However, we do know how it works, though, that good public relations and good strategic maneuvers is capable of resurrecting the worst of situations. We see it all the time. So look for more of this. Which agency will be the next one to do something that seems to be bucking the truth embargo or mitigating the situation or just showing that they're on our side? Which one will it be? I can't wait to find out.
Nor can I. And, Steve, right now I just received a nudge from one of the individuals in the room. They've really enjoyed hearing this conversation. Very, very informative. And, again, thank you for reading both your open memo to the president and also the text of the disclosure petition for. Beautifully drafted and very well submitted. And, Steve, please be our soon return guest. And at this point, I'd like to thank our audience for joining us this evening. We appreciate your time with us. Have a great weekend, and thank you again, Steve.
Yes, you're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks, everyone, for joining us this evening on A Global Focus with guest Stephen Bassett, Executive Director of the Paradigm Research Group, with website at paradigmresearchgroup.org. Your time spent with us this evening is appreciated, and we wish everyone a great summer weekend.